Okay, good morning, everyone. I now call the Senate Law and Justice Committee to order. Welcome committee members, staff, testifiers, and all who are watching live from TVW to the Senate Law and Justice Committee meeting. My name is Manka Tingra. I'm the state senator from the 45th Legislative District, and it is my honor to chair this fine committee. We have a full agenda before us, like every single time. But before we begin, I would like to go over the guidelines of engagement during this virtual meeting. Members, please do stay on camera unless you have technical issues that way our testifiers can see you. As is customary at committee hearings, please raise your hand to ask a question. Since we are on Zoom, please do mute yourself when you have finished asking your question. To everyone who has signed up to testify, sent in their written comments, or indicated their position on a bill, thank you so much for participating and for providing your feedback. Once a bill is introduced, the testifiers will be moved to become panelists. Please do keep yourself off camera and mute until called to testify. After your testimony, please go ahead and mute yourself and take yourself off camera. Please do stay until the entire panel is done testifying in case there are any questions from members. Members and staff can access meeting materials in EBB, and the public can follow along with the documents by going to the ledge.wa.gov website and looking for committee schedules. And with that, I would like to now ask members to introduce themselves, starting with our ranking member, Senator Patton.
Well, good Monday morning to you, Chair Dingra. I'm Senator Mike Patton. I have the honor of representing the 4th Legislative District on the eastern front of our state up against the Idaho border, including the cities of Spokane Valley, Liberty Lake, Millwood. Also, one interesting fact about the district, we have the Centennial Trail, a wonderful trail for bicycling and walking up against the Spokane River from the western end of the district on Havana all the way to the Idaho border. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Patton. And I think for all those parents thinking about spring break, I think Senator Patton may have just given you a suggestion on what you may want to do. Senator Trudeau.
Good morning, everyone. Yasmin Trudeau, representing the 27th Legislative District, which is large parts of Tacoma, Dash Point, and Fife.
Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Jamie Peterson from the 43rd District in Central Seattle.
And next up is going to be Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Senator Keith Wagoner, representing the 39th Legislative District, parts of Skagit, Snohomish, and King counties.
Thank you. Senator Cooter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everyone. Senator Patty Cooter from the 48th Legislative District. That's parts of Bellevue, Redmond, Kirkland, and Yarrow Point, Hunts Point, Medina, and Clydehill.
Thank you, Senator Cooter. Next up will be Senator McCune.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Senator McCune. I represent the 2nd Legislative District, which encompasses North Pierce, Thurston County and South Pierce County. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Solomon?
Morning. I represent the 32nd District. That is North King County, including Shoreline and North Seattle, as well as South Snohomish County. That's Linwood, parts of Edmonds, parts of Mount Lake Terrace, and also I forgot Woodway in King County. No, Snohomish County. So many jurisdictions. Jeez.
Senator Honeyford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Jim Honeyford, representing the 15th District, Eastern Yakima County. And for Senator Patton, I have advice on that trail. Start in Idaho because it's uphill all the way from Spokane. That's what we did, and it was a 100-degree day, and darn near killed us.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to start with a confirmation hearing. And so I call Senate Gubernatorial Appointment 9099, Guadalupe Gamboa. Is Guadalupe Gamboa present?
Present.
Thank you. Senate Rule 69 requires that your testimony before this committee be under oath or affirmation. Please raise your right hand. Do you, Guadalupe Gamboa, swear or affirm that your testimony and documents presented to this committee are truthful?
I do.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and provide us with a little information about yourself and your background.
My name is Guadalupe Gamboa. I go by Lupe Gamboa, and I'm originally born in Texas, and my parents came up here in the late 40s as migrant farm workers and settled in the area of Sunnyside, where Mr. Honeyford was my senator for a while. And I grew up, graduated from Sunnyside High School, went to YBC, then University of Washington. And first in my family to go to higher, you know, secondary education. And and because of where I grew up and you know, I started working when I was a child, you know, at that time, thanks to the Washington State Legislature, child labor was allowed in Washington State. And I've been working all my life, basically, until I retired several years ago. And in the meantime, I worked as an organizer for the Farm Workers Union, which I'm very proud of. I also was the first student from a farm worker background to be admitted to the University of Washington Law School way back in 1968. And left the law school, worked with the Farm Workers Union for 7 years, and went back and completed my studies. And anyway, it's a long history. So I think you have kind of the gist of where I'm coming from.
I've been with the
Human Rights Commission since, I believe, 2016.
Thank you so much. That actually sounds like an extremely impressive background, and I know I could hear more details about that for hours. Can you just tell us a little bit more about the work that you've been doing on the Human Rights Commission since 2016?
I am a commissioner, and under the statute, commissioners have final say on all the cases that are accepted or rejected by the commission. And but we don't do the first cut. The first cut is done by staff at the commission, and then it's reviewed by the director and her assistant, and then it comes to us. And but we do get all the cases that are reviewed on a monthly basis, which are, you know, can be quite a few, 100 or so, and some that we think need more facts or were wrongly decided, we do have the power to ask that they be reviewed again. And so I've been sitting on the commission doing that. And I work with private practice, and I did a lot of employment discrimination here in Seattle for a while. And so I do have a lot of experience in this area.
Thank you so much. Do other members have any questions? Yes, Senator Patton.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Gamboa, so the Human Rights Commission is certainly a quasi-judicial commission, and I'm sure everybody on it and all of us have views, life experience that have formed our views. Are you able, do you think, to take an independent look at any cases that come before you, any public hearings or other reviews, and make the appropriate decisions according to the law?
Yes, I think my background actually helps me apply the law more correctly, and also to interpret the law. As I said, we don't make the initial cut. It's done by by staff that usually are not lawyers. So we just basically review their reviewed by the director and her assistant. And so our role is actually pretty limited. It's just making sure that no obvious mistakes are being made. And we just have so many cases that I think my life experience and my training helps me go through the cases pretty fast. And as a lawyer, lawyers have to follow the law also, you know, so you can't, you can't take on cases that you're obviously going to lose. And so the answer is yes, I can take an independent look at the cases.
Thank you. Senator Honeyford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to welcome fellow Grizzly. And when you were growing up and I was growing up, we used to get up at 4:30 and go out and cut asparagus before school.
That's right.
Then take a nap in school. That's all I have.
When did you graduate from high from Sunnyside High, Senator?
Long time ago, 1957.
Oh, yeah, I graduated in 1964.
Excellent. Okay, do any other members have any questions?
Long time ago, too.
Yeah, we're both ancient.
Okay, seeing none, thank you for your testimony. The confirmation hearing for Senate Gubernatorial Appointment 9099, Guadalupe Gamboa, is concluded. Thank you.
Thank you.
And next up, since I see that Senator Warnick has joined us, we are going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5920. Thank you so much, Senator Warnick, for bringing this bill to us, and welcome to the Senate Law and Justice Committee. And we will start with a staff briefing on Senate Bill 5920.
Hey, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ryan Giannini, staff counsel to this committee. Before you today, Senate Bill 5920 concerning parenting plans. By way of background, in dissolution or legal separation cases in which there are minor children, the court must establish a parenting plan that provides for the care of the minor children. The parenting plan must establish a residential schedule for the children. The residential schedule designates in which parent's home the child resides on given days of the year. Generally, a court may order adjustments to the residential aspects of a parenting plan upon a showing of a substantial change in circumstances with respect to either parents or the child. If the proposed modification is only a minor modification, the modification does not change the residence the child is scheduled to reside in the majority of the time. And among other considerations, the court finds that it is in the best interest of the child to increase residential time with a parent with whom the child does not reside a majority of the time. A parent with whom a minor child does not reside with the majority of the time not seek expansion of residential time if the court precluded or limited any provisions of the parenting plan based on a finding that a long-term impairment resulting from drug, alcohol, or other substance abuse interferes with the parent's performance of parenting functions, unless the moving parent demonstrates a substantial change in circumstances specifically related to the long-term impairment. Current law does not define a substantial change in circumstances. Senate Bill 5920 would have the following effects. It would define a substantial change in circumstances as a period of more than 24 consecutive months during which a moving parent, by clear and convincing evidence, has not used drugs, alcohol, or other substances. It establishes how a moving parent may demonstrate clear and convincing evidence, which is generally established by submitting a report to the court of no use of drugs, alcohol, or other substances for a period of 24 consecutive months or more. It establishes criteria for testing facilities used by a moving parent to prepare reports showing no use of drugs, alcohol, or other substances. And finally, it allows courts discretion to modify parenting plans when the moving parent demonstrates that he or she has not used drugs, alcohol, or other substances for less than 24 consecutive months. A fiscal note was not requested. Are there any questions?
Thank you so much for that briefing, Ryan. Do any of the members have any questions for staff? Yes, Senator Wagner.
Thank you. I'm wondering about the 24-month period. Is that a time period that's been scientifically arrived at, or is it sort of just a random number that sounds nice because it's 2 years? I'm just wondering how we came to that number.
Thank you for your question, Senator. I would have to defer your question to the prime sponsor of the bill.
Okay, I'll wait. Thank you.
Any other questions for staff? Seeing none, Senator Warnick, welcome. Always a pleasure to hear your bills. And would you like to speak about your bill?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for hearing the bill. For the record, I'm Senator Judy Warnick, 13th Legislative District, and I'll describe it since you got to describe your districts. Goes from Spokane County line to King County line right now, so it's going to be changing, but I miss this committee. I served with Senator Peterson when we were both in the House on the Judiciary Committee, and I miss the issues that you hear in this particular committee. But I am I'm finding myself more and more working on reunification of families, whether it's behavioral health issues, whether it's foster children that need to get back to their families, or now recovery issues. King County Councilman Reagan Dunn brought this idea to my attention just a few months ago, and I was lax in getting the bill dropped, so I apologize, but I appreciate you hearing the bill for us. And I just want to be able to help children and their parents get back after a period of time. And your question, Senator Wagner, about 24 months, I thought that that might be a good time period to prove that this particular person or this particular parent would be on the road to recovery. Recovery is not easy. I've known people who have gone through that, and it's very, very difficult. So I believe there's items built into this bill that will help prove that this person indeed has reached recovery. So a shorter time period might be considered. I have talked to a couple people about the bill before it was heard today, asking if I'd be interested in changing time periods. So very open, but my goal is to help reunite families all over the state of Washington. And whether it's behavioral health, or mental health, or other reasons, foster children, or now the recovery, the parent who is recovering. So there'll be people who testify to the need for this bill, and I really appreciate Councilman Dunn bringing the idea to me, and open for questions.
Thank you. Do any of the members have any questions for the prime sponsor? Okay, seeing none, thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, I invite Reagan Dunn to please identify himself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Reagan Dunn. I'm a member of the King County Council and also chair of the National Alliance for Parents in Recovery. I come wearing both hats today. This is a top priority for the Alliance, as well as part of the county's legislative agenda, which was unanimously approved by the County Council. I'm now in my fifth year of recovery from alcohol abuse. And when I finally stopped drinking, I agreed to a parenting plan, which was very restrictive and allowed precious little time with my children each week. After I achieved sobriety, I was determined to become the father that my children deserved. It wasn't enough to be sober, of course. I also wanted expanded time with my children so I could be a regular part of their lives. So I started going to a DOT certified testing laboratory every 90 days and submitting a hair follicle test for alcohol, which goes back a full 3 months. The problem was state law is vague, and I didn't know how long I should do this testing before trying to approach a court to modify my parenting plan. I achieved a year of proven sobriety, then 2 years, then 3 years. And finally, after more than 3 years, I began the lengthy and potentially expensive process to modify my parenting plan with absolutely no certainty whether this would be enough proven sobriety under state law. I am thankful a series of judges were convinced it was enough time. And today I have my children on a regular schedule, but I really worry that many others in recovery like me will face the daunting challenge of modifying their parenting plan and perhaps never attempt to do so without this proposed clarity in state law. SB 5920 sets an important goalpost for those in recovery and says that if you can prove something like 2 years of continuous abstinence, we're flexible on that length of time, a judge must at least open up your parenting plan and see if it should be improved. Take it from me. There is no greater motivating factor for a parent to get sober than a path to a closer relationship with your children. And I believe the law should reflect that. Thanks for the time.
Thank you so much for your advocacy and for your testimony. Next up will be Taylor Collier.
Hello, I'm Taylor Collier, and I feel completely inadequate with my background compared to all of you. So, well done. I Ranking Member Patton, Vice Chair Trudeau, and other committee members, thank you for letting me speak today to explain my subject area of expertise on matters related to SB 5920. I am the president and CEO of ArcPoint Labs of Greater Seattle. We're a leading provider of comprehensive drug, alcohol, and DNA testing services. We're also expert in COVID testing services, and we serve primarily employers and travelers, passengers in that area. Our clients include large and small businesses, shipping companies, airline passengers, legal firms, and we do a substantial amount of work in family court cases and family law. We're nationally affiliated with many organizations that seek to make our homes, schools, workplaces, and communities safer places. Many people are not aware that we now have a variety of tools in our toolkit for assisting with this question of what is sobriety and what is usage. I want to explain for a minute that there are multiple types of testing available now for drugs. We have saliva testing, which has a two-day window of detection. We have the traditional UA or urine testing, which most people are familiar with, which is about 3 to 4 days for most drugs, up to 30 days for marijuana. However, we also have hair testing available now, and hair testing can do 3 months on your head hair, up to 12 months on your body hair. We have nail testing available. You do your fingernails. It's about 6 months of detection period and 12 months for toenails. And one of the reasons we really like hair and nail testing is because it's comprehensive. It covers this entire period. You do your random UAs and you may or may not catch somebody in the moment. And so by having all of these different tools in your toolkit and available to a judge, well, then they can make sure that they are providing the testing that is the most appropriate for the situation. The other thing that I really like about it is it gives the parent an opportunity to prove without doubt that they have sobriety. And by using this hair and nail testing, you now as a parent have this ability to prove your sobriety. In family and law matters, I've seen random drug testing act as a deterrent to use, but equally important, I have several clients who purposely do hair and nail testing to provide comprehensive proof of abstinence. These are parents who realize they may have made previous mistakes with substances, and they're now willing to do whatever it takes to spend more time with their children. We support the clarification offered by this bill, as we believe it will provide additional incentive to parents in recovery and will help children by giving them more time with parents who love them. I want to thank all the members of this committee again for listening to my testimony and allowing me to share my personal insight and expertise in this area.
Thank you so much for that. Do any of the members have any questions for any of the testifiers? Okay. Seeing none, thank you so much. We are now going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5920, and we will go to Senate Bill 5883, starting with a staff briefing.
Morning, Chair Dingra and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Ford, staff counsel with the committee. Before you is Senate Bill 5883. It relates to an unaccompanied homeless youth's ability to provide informed consent for their own health care. By way of background, parental notification and consent is required for a minor to receive basic health services until the minor has reached the age of majority, which in Washington State is generally 18 years of age. Washington State has established a lower age of consent for certain specific health needs, but it's only when it's created by law. So informed consent for healthcare on behalf of a patient, a minor, who is not otherwise authorized to provide informed consent may be obtained from a school nurse, a school counselor, or a homeless student liaison when the minor patient meets the definition of a homeless child or youth under federal law. And also the minor patient is not under the supervision or control of a parent or custodian or legal guardian, or not in custody and control of the Department of Social and Health Services. And consent is necessary for that type of care. What this bill does is it permits an unaccompanied homeless minor to provide informed consent for non-emergency outpatient primary health care services. And those are the types of services such as physical examinations, vision examinations and eyeglasses, dental examinations and hearing aids, immunizations, treatments for illnesses and conditions, and routine follow-up care provided by a healthcare provider in an outpatient setting. Bill also allows but does not require a healthcare provider to request documentation that a patient is an unaccompanied homeless minor, and that documentation could be provided by staff at a governmental or nonprofit human services agency or homeless services agency, or an attorney representing the minor or an adult relative of the minor with knowledge of the minor and the minor's housing situation. And then finally, the bill grants immunity from administrative or civil liability for both the healthcare provider when it provides healthcare services in good faith upon consent of the minor, and also it grants liability for providing documentation in good faith based on the knowledge that the patient is an unaccompanied homeless minor. A fiscal note was not requested. Any questions?
Thank you so much. Yes, I see hands up already. Senator Patton.
Yes, thank you, Tim, for the report. Is there any lower age limit on this, or any age limit at all to, on it?
Not in the bill. No, there's no age limit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Solomon?
I would assume the waiver of liability does not waive standard of care requirements. Is that correct? It just waives the ability to sue for treating a minor child without parental consent in this instance?
That's correct. It's based upon the informed consent, the homeless youth. It would not be changing standards of medical malpractice.
Thank you.
Any other questions for staff? Okay, seeing then, Senator Trudeau, would you like to speak about your bill?
Yes, and good morning, Madam Chair, Ranking Member Patton, and my esteemed colleagues on this committee. Yasmeen Trudeau, representing the 27th Legislative District, and asking for your support of Senate Bill 5883. Just wanted to ask at the outright, who are we talking about? You heard a limited staff briefing, but I just wanted to put a finer point on the fact that these are young people who are experiencing homelessness and not in the physical custody of a parent or guardian. And if we can just be candid, many of these youth are either unable to go home because of fear of the situation they left, or sometimes simply there is just no home to go back to. They're incredibly vulnerable for many reasons, some of which you'll hear in testimony, and are often lacking the basic simple supports that we may all take for granted. You might also be asking about whether the mature minor doctrine is an option here. And what I've heard and why I chose to bring this bill forward is that, unfortunately, the doctrine still leaves out this demographic in particular for a couple reasons I want to offer. One is many providers are unaware of it or don't apply it due to the perceived liability issues, which you hear this bill addresses. And for youth who are not enrolled in school or connected with school staff, they're not able to benefit from that school officials' consent. Furthermore, the bill does not help when a youth needs care services during summer or during other school closure periods. These are youth that have experienced trauma and instability, often at the hands of their immediate family members and guardians, but they still deserve access to care. I would offer that without it, minor issues can often result in expensive emergency room visits for care or leaving some conditions to go on without adequate treatment, leaving the system to cover very high expenses on the back end of many of these healthcare situations. Recently, this has been amplified because during the pandemic, the population has continued to face barriers in accessing COVID-19 vaccinations and adequate testing opportunities as a result. These are not youth with stable homes to isolate in. They often have no support systems if they are sick. You will hear from advocates that the hope is that a statutory change would not have been needed, and folks have worked diligently for years trying to resolve this issue, only to be told that it really can only be immediately addressed through a statutory fix, which is why we're here before you with this bill. I would ask you all to look at all of the stakeholders that work directly with these populations and members of these populations who will testify today, all signed in pro. And I just want to note that I appreciate that some people may have really strong feelings about these issues and these populations. And I ask only that we approach difficult issues with an open heart. And I want to thank everyone for their engagement in advance. As mentioned, the pandemic highlighted the need for this change, but it was determined that case law in this area is not clear and consistent. And despite efforts at the state agency and provider level, barriers continued to exist. So you'll hear about efforts and outreach in a moment. I would offer that I have experienced youth homelessness, and during a darker point in my life, I was not able to return home or engage with my parents on important decisions. but I was lucky that I was not living on the streets and I had people with open hearts who opened their homes to me. And I was also lucky that during those 4 years, I did not need to visit a doctor, wasn't acutely sick. But most are not that lucky. And I often think of policy in terms of how this plays out in the real world. I wasn't in the middle of a pandemic. And again, I didn't get sick or need life-affirming or life-saving care. So while we, of course, want to focus on the family, in reality, this is simply not an option for the folks that we're describing. And we have to be responsive to the needs of our most vulnerable and not just project what we want to see, but meet people where they're at to make an opportunity for informed decisions. And now, as we move through the current challenges of the pandemic and are attempting to stabilize and support our unhoused community members, I really think this is one opportunity to help ensure public safety and well-being and get folks on the road to a more stable and healthy future. So I hope you'll support me in moving this issue forward, and I want to thank everyone for their time.
Thank you so much, Senator Trudeau. Do any members have any questions for the prime sponsor? Okay, seeing none, I would now like to welcome Elizabeth Dawson. Please do introduce yourself and begin.
And members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Dawson and I'm 15 years old. I would like to share with you why Senate Bill 5883 is so important for young people like me. My grandma adopted me when I was four. Because of my grandma, I had someone who was responsible for me, including consenting for my health care. My grandmother passed away in October of last year. She had been sick for several months, and on top of everything else, I was worried about not knowing what to do if I got sick. Everyone was worried about COVID, and I couldn't even get tested. I was without health care for 6 months. I tried at least four times during those 6 months to get health care. I asked my uncle to help me, but he wouldn't come into the doctor's office with me. My older brother, who lives in Federal Way, tried, but he couldn't help me. When I finally was able to get an appointment, the doctor's office and I said I need a parent and with me or someone to sign the consent form they gave me. I didn't have anyone. I tried to fill out the form myself. But when I brought it back to them, they told me I'd done it wrong, but they didn't help me. I also reached out to my school, but schools are busy right now. And then it was the holiday break. Recently, I've been able to work with my school to get support and services. Fortunately, through all this, I have been able to still see my counselor. She helped me find a lawyer at Legal Counsel for Youth and Children to help me figure out who can take care of me. My lawyer told me about the mature and minor doctrine and explained to me that I might be able to consent for my own health care. It took a lot of coordination and meetings between my therapist, my lawyer at LCYC, and my doctor to get the mature and minor doctrine applied. It hasn't been easy. Luckily, I've been meeting with my therapist for about 5 years, and they were able to provide a lot of evidence that I'm a mature minor for my doctor. A lot of young people in my situation might not have this amount of support. How would they even hear about the mature minor doctrine? I just wanted to see my doctor to make sure that I was healthy and not sick. My experience has been that even when someone wanted to help me, it was often complicated and confusing. It took me a really long time to finally get healthcare, and many people involved did not know about the mature minor doctrine or how to use it. Please help young people like me who are trying to take care of ourselves so we can become healthy adults. To do that, we need you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Next up will be Cora Bruno.
Good morning, and thank you so much for being with my esteemed colleagues. And that last testimony just really pulled at my heartstrings. I am a pediatrician, and I've been taking care of homeless youth for over 20 years. And I speak in wholehearted support of SB 5883 on behalf of the Washington chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, representing over 1,200 pediatricians. As a physician, again, who's been serving homeless youth for over 20 years, my thoughts have turned to two young folk. One is a young man for whom I had the privilege to provide care. Late one evening, when most teenagers are resting safely in their homes, he presented to a shelter for unaccompanied youth. And for those of you that were outside last night, it was a light night like last night, where it was pouring, windy, cold, and he was terrified and had been living in a terrible, dangerous home situation, but preferred to be on the streets versus in his home, and he was merely 16 years of age. Each year in the state of Washington, nearly 13,000 youth and young adults experience homelessness, with Black, Native American, LGBTQ, and parenting youth overrepresented. And while this number may seem alarming, it is still definitely an underestimation of our young folk who are living on the streets. In the months that followed after I saw this young man, we were able to provide and refer him to both acute and preventive health care, including dental and vision that he desperately needed. He wanted to be more than the trauma he survived, which was horrific. With safe shelter and the ability to advocate and consent for his healthcare needs, he's now been finishing high school and plans to become a veterinarian. So hopefully he'll be working in Eastern Washington with you senators on the farms, taking care of the animals. The other patient I would like to discuss was a young woman who was also on the streets. She was 17 years of age and again had to leave a situation that was untenable and deliberately was trying to survive while living under bridges in tents and being trafficked in ways that was abominable to be even discussed. I convinced her, because she was definitely smart, to take GED and see where she was. She got one of the highest scores in the state, and she went to an Ivy League college on the East Coast, full ride for 4 years, and is now a lawyer practicing in New Haven with Yale. These are people who have dreams. They have loves, they have passions, which should not be ignored, and they need to be taken care of by those of us who can do it without any kind of inference or liability for providing care for these youths, including vision, dentistry, preventive care, sexual transmission screening, and also making sure that they get back to school and find food and warmth and housing and someone who loves them and cares for them. Adolescence is a critical period in a young person's life that encompasses unique developmental milestones. With personalized education and counseling, adolescents in partnership with their providers, those of us that can and want and need to take care of them, can make thoughtful healthcare decisions. This bill will ensure that adolescents, including unaccompanied youth experiencing homelessness, have access to comprehensive health services that can promote their development and well-being, leading to a successful transition into adulthood where they can fulfill their dreams. Thank you for the opportunity to express my support of SB 5883. I'm honored to be here.
Thank you so much. Next up will be Charles Atkins.
Good morning, Chair Dingra and distinguished members of the committee. My name is Charles Atkins. I'm the Health Policy Director of the Children's Alliance, and I'm here today to express my deep support for Senate Bill 5883 and Children's Alliance's support for 5883. Less than 7 years ago, I was a homeless high schooler. I was homeless for over 3 years throughout high school. And throughout my period of homelessness, I had the wonderful opportunity to eventually find shelter at Cocoon House, a shelter for homeless teenagers here in Everett. While there, I repeatedly found myself unable to get health care, with providers commonly refusing to provide care unless I had a parent or legal guardian with me. I was lucky I was eventually able to receive care from Indian Health Services after several months of trying to receive care with clinics here in Everett. If this bill was law when I was homeless, I would not have run into these problems and would have gotten the care and, more importantly, the immunizations I needed far more quickly. I also knew and continue to know plenty of youth who continue to run into these issues and continue to not have access to other healthcare options because of this issue. Senate Bill 5883 is good policy and ensures our most disadvantaged youth are able to receive the health care they need and also eliminates any ambiguity in its current statute. I urge your support and vote for this amazing piece of legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Next up is going to be Julie Barrett. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you all having me here today. My name is Julie Barrett. I am the founder of Conservative Ladies of Washington. I represent 10,000 women throughout the state of Washington. I'm also a mother of five and a Snohomish County resident, and I'm here today as a mom, testifying as a mom. I am here to voice my opposition to Senate Bill 5883. Last March, my 14-year-old daughter was suicidal. She was taken by ambulance to Seattle Children's Hospital. They moved her a few hours later without my consent to the Paul G. Allen Homeless Shelter for Youth run by Youth Care in Seattle. They kept her there for 10 days. The shelter would not allow us to communicate with our child in any way. They availed our daughter with a razor, which she used to harm herself, which necessitated another trip to Seattle Children's Hospital, where the homeless shelter changed all of her records to their address, to their employees, and took my husband and I off of her medical records. They also got her a lawyer and were working with her to file a CHINS petition, a child in need of services petition. My daughter comes from a loving home. She is not homeless and she did not need services. She was sexually abused by her birth father and was in desperate need of mental health care, which was not provided through the shelter, nor from their unlicensed social worker, which the State Board of Health didn't seem concerned with when I reported that. She was rescued by 8 Seattle police officers and to this day is out of Washington State, where she is receiving the mental health treatment she needs, because Washington state laws do not allow us to parent. Senate Bill 5883 is a direct attack on parental rights by cutting out the need for any consent. Any parent can tell you that teenagers can be rebellious. This bill would make it easier for organizations like Youth Care, who will benefit from tax dollars and state funding, to prey on teens who have run away from loving parents. This bill will not just apply to homeless youth. It will apply to kids who have good homes and good parents. This bill opens the door to a wide variety of opportunities for youth to be preyed upon by an adult with an agenda that is not in their best interest. Among the many concerns in this bill, there is no age stipulation for youth in the language of the bill, and no one is held liable in the event of harm. I will be submitting written testimony so that you can read more about our horrific story as a family and trying to help our mentally ill child. I am urging you, please do not pass Senate Bill 5883. As you all are well aware, there is the mature minor doctrine in this state that already gives children over the age of 13 the ability to seek health care. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for that, and thank you for submitting the written testimony. Mm-hmm. Next up will be Eric Pratt.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Eric Pratt, and I reside in the 24th Legislative District. I'm here to give my opposition as a single father of two children to SB 5833, as this appears to be a reckless and potentially harmful bill that seemingly is designed poorly and could be abused by any number of people, both adolescents in need and adults at various levels of the homeless assistance system. This bill reads as though any person with knowledge, verified or not, can potentially vouch for a minor's homeless status. I believe it's line 31 on page 6, line 39 on page 6. It also appears that this has very little in the way of due process in establishing the validity of these claims, as line 31 on page 6, the healthcare provider may, but is not forced to, required to request this documentation. So they can just do things at their whim. I find this to be potentially hazardous in the long run. It even goes so far as to eliminate potential liabilities that may be the only sanction and measure that could prevent abuse of this reckless bill. I can assure you that I support and want to help all youth and families in need, but I do not support the exploitation of emotional currency in potentially undermining the sanctity of the family without strict due process and strict measures to enforce its proper use. I myself have been had experiences with one of the Washington laws 71.34.530 regarding the mental health care of a minor, in which I was cut out of my even knowledge or input into my child's care, my 14-year-old daughter, by virtue of one single health care professional taking and interpreting one page of a survey and then cutting me out of all decisions and information. And like RCW 71.34.530, laws regarding mental health care of a minor, this opens the door to a future of further potential harm and regular abuse to children and young adults at their most vulnerable. Family and parental involvement are the most important, and this must be at the forefront of any matters dealing with youth health care, homeless or not. Protect the youth and the families. Do not allow further erosion of the family.
Thank you, Mr.
Please
Pratt.
Oppose it in its entirety.
Thank
Have
you.
Have a nice day.
You too. Next up will be Kara Helmer.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kara Helmer, and I am the Policy Director of Legal Affairs at the Washington State Hospital Association. WISHA represents all hospitals in Washington State. I am testifying other today on Senate Bill 5883. WISHA supports access to care for unaccompanied homeless children and youth. we worked on the existing informed consent statute that allows consent for homeless youth, and we appreciate the need for this additional section. I'm testifying other because the bill before you could use amendments to increase clarity and consistency with the original structure of this carefully crafted section of statute. Under Section 1.3c of the bill, we would ask that the liability protections for providers parallel the language from the currently existing informed consent law, which also relates to consent for homeless youth. Our amendment creates consistency with the informed consent statute and gives treating providers and facilities the reassurance that they need so that they're able to treat the minors under this section in good faith without legal consequences or repercussions to their licenses. And then additionally, in Section 1.3b, the language in the bill should be amended to parallel the documentation requirements in existing law regarding consent for homeless minors. This would include language specifying that documentation from adults be provided in written form under penalty of perjury. And then finally, there's other minor language adjustments that we would recommend also to align this new section with the rest of the statute. And this would include using the term minor patient, for example, which again is consistent with the existing informed consent statute. In closing, we would note that over the past few years, the structure of this statute, especially as it relates to consent for minors, has become increasingly complex, especially considering that it must be interpreted by healthcare providers with no formal legal training. And our state has long had a doctrine allowing mature minors and statutory law allowing emancipated minors to consent to healthcare. And more recently, numerous additional exceptions have been added. And as I said, we absolutely support efforts to increase access, but we're becoming increasingly concerned about the ability of care providers to focus on caring for kids as opposed to parsing through legal jargon and worrying about their liability. So we would ask the legislature, if you would advance this bill, to please consider if there is a more workable approach for care providers in the future. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and we look forward to seeing the written amendments that you testified about. Okay. Next up is going to be Megan Vaith. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Megan Vaith, and I am a senior manager at Building Changes. This bill would help a very specific population of young people in accessing healthcare services, those who are unaccompanied and experiencing homelessness. This can include situations where a family is evicted and cannot find housing, so the student stays temporarily on a friend's couch, or when a youth leaves home because they are in danger from an abusive parent. There are many scenarios where youth may find themselves dealing with homelessness. One way we can help is removing the barrier for them in accessing healthcare. Because they do not have a parent or guardian to consent for them, these young people are oftentimes unable to get the healthcare they want and need. Building Changes and our partners have spent nearly 2 years trying to get clarity on this issue. In Washington State, there are two laws that are relevant here, but they're not enough. The mature minor doctrine from state case law is not effective for all young people, as many healthcare providers are unaware of the doctrine or choose not to apply it due to lack of guidance. Under state statutory law, certain school staff can provide informed consent for healthcare for unaccompanied homeless youth. This has helped many young people get care. However, young people who are not enrolled in school or connected to school staff, especially during vacations or breaks, may not benefit. It's crucial that young people can access and receive healthcare. Receiving healthcare can also help connect young people to caring adults who can link them to other care and social services. This is a statewide issue, as the youth rates of homelessness are similarly high in both rural and urban areas, and BIPOC and LGBTQ plus youth are both disproportionately represented. We urge the committee to support Senate Bill 5883 and ensure young people can access and receive the healthcare they want and need. This is about supporting young people during a health crisis and making sure they have a healthy foundation for the rest of their lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is going to be Bridget Cannon.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bridget Cannon. I'm the Senior Vice President of Youth Services for Volunteers of America in Eastern Washington and Northern Idaho in Spokane. I've been working with our under 18 youth shelter since 1998. The youth in our shelter have at very best limited contact with their parents or guardians due to the abusive nature of the family. Overwhelmingly, medical providers in our community are either not informed about the mature minor doctrine or are very wary of invoking the doctrine for fear they could be sued. At the beginning of the pandemic, we had youth in our shelter displaying symptoms of COVID-19 and had to go to the ER for treatment. They were denied a COVID test because of a lack of parental consent. We contacted our local regional health district to come and test both the youth and the staff, but they were very hesitant to test the youth. It took several hours of persuasive talking to convince them to test the youth as well. They've also had difficulty accessing vaccines. We've had several opportunities to partner with local medical internship programs to provide voluntary preventative care clinics on site until they found out the parental consent may not be available. I would explain the mature minor doctrine, but they were still unwilling to acknowledge the doctrine and the opportunities were withdrawn. These youth already have so little in their lives they can control. The least we can do is allow them to control having their blood pressure taken, their eyes checked, and their teeth cleaned. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any of the members have any questions for any of the panelists? Okay. Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 5883, and we're going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 5779. Staff, can we have a briefing on that bill, please?
Of course. Good morning again, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ryan Giannini, staff counsel to this committee. Before you today, Senate Bill 5779 relating to oversight of bail funds. By way of background, the Charitable Solicitations Act regulates charitable organizations and commercial fundraisers in the state. Under the CSA, charitable organizations and commercial fundraisers that solicit contributions from the public must first register with the Office of the Secretary of State before conducting any solicitations. Each application for registration, whether initial or renewal, must include specific information as provided in statute, including a solicitation report of the organization for the preceding accounting year. Charitable organizations that raise less than $50,000 per year are exempt from registration, provided the fundraising is conducted by volunteers and the officers or members of the organization do not receive assets or benefits from the organization. Charitable organizations are also exempt from registration if appeals for funds or on behalf of a specific individual named in the solicitation if all the proceeds of the solicitation are given to or expended for the direct benefit of that individual. The Office of the Washington State Auditor has the power to examine the financial affairs of all governments in the state, including local governments, schools, state agencies, and institutions of higher education. Pretrial release is the release of the accused from custody pending trial. Bail allows the defendant to be released from custody only upon the posting of cash or other security with the court. Bail is fulfilled by the posting of a bond. The defendant may post cash, securities, or other liquid assets to satisfy the amount of the bond. Bail funds generally provide cash bail for people charged with crimes who are unable to afford bail and who are incarcerated while awaiting court appearances. Senate Bill 5779 would have the following effects. It would define bail funds as charitable organizations that collect money for the purposes of securing a person's release before trial with the payment of bail. It will require that bail funds disclose in an application for initial registration or renewal information about each case where a bail fund contributed money towards the payment of bail. Such information includes the crime charged, the maximum possible penalty of the crime charged, the amount of bail posted, and the percentage of the amount of bail posted that was contributed by the bail fund. It would require that bail funds publish this information quarterly, make such information available on their websites, and disclose such information to their donors. And finally, it would allow the state auditor to conduct an audit of bail funds to ensure financial and legal compliance. A fiscal note is available. Are there any questions?
Thank you so much for that, Ryan. Do any of the members have any questions for staff? Okay, seeing none, Senator Patton, would you like to speak about your bill?
Thank you very much, Senator Dingra, for granting this bill a hearing. And I do have a few points I'd like to make about the bill. And the bill is intended to increase transparency on these bail funds, so we have more information. It does nothing to prohibit the bail funds from continuing to do the work they do. You know, on May 25th, 2000, after George Floyd was killed, protests and riots came up, people were arrested. And later, not too long after, bail relief funds started popping up across the country, promising to pay the bail for people arrested during some of these protests and riots. Many of these bail relief funds initially intended to focus on lower level offenses, such as protest related offenses. Even Vice President Kamala Harris tweeted out her support of the Minnesota Freedom Fund. It turned out that that fund was originally set up to aid in the paying of bail for protesters, but later, and I'm sure unbeknownst to her, was used to help meet bail on a domestic abuser who later went on to commit murder. There's other examples around the country. Massachusetts, a convicted rapist was set free. So some of these payment of bail efforts have not made our communities safer, which I think we all want. All the members on the committee I know want that. And there are many other examples that if you did a Google search, you could find. So I thought, you know, some oversight and transparency of these bail relief funds would be a positive thing. And I don't know the exact number of these funds in our state. I do know there is a group in Spokane called the Bail Disruptors that has been active. And I believe there are other bail relief funds in other parts of the state. And so I think it's good that the public that contributes these funds know where the money is going. And if they are indeed intending that they go for low-level offenders and find out that they're going for more serious criminals, I think they would be concerned. So this bill provides transparency without requiring onerous requirements on the actual fund. If they're a charitable organization, they already should register with the Secretary of State. And the bill ensures transparency. I would point out that there is support from law enforcement, although not testifying publicly. They have signed in support of the bill, the Fraternal Order of Police and the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Patton. And do any members? Yes, Senator Trudeau.
Thank you. And I just wanted to show appreciation for Senator Patton's comments. I think there was a lot of confusion by folks that were engaging and paying bail on all sides of issues over the last couple of years. So appreciate the intent. I'm curious why there would be exemptions for smaller organizations. And then also if this bill contemplates individual folks, maybe wealthy folks that want to step in and create GoFundMes or whatever. Just curious why there might be some exemptions in here that differentiate between larger and smaller organizations. And if you've thought about maybe individuals engaging and transparency needed there.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly open to that. But I think as indicated in the bill report, you know, 50,000 and under is exempt probably because it is such a small amount and would be used presumably for lower level offenders. But I'm certainly open to any suggestions, Senator Trudeau, you might have on how the bill could be improved. There are some states that are actually attempting to restrict the ability of this to be done at all. I know there's legislation in Indiana and Kentucky that's pending.
Thank you. Sarah Solomon, do you have a question? You're on mute, Senator.
Thank you. I don't know if this is best answered by staff or by Senator Patton or somebody else. I have seen these bail funds active in non-protest domestic violence criminal cases, and I'm just curious how these bail funds are capitalized. I just don't really understand how that works.
I believe, Senator Solomon, it's donations by people. I don't know if there's other organizations, nonprofits that contribute to them or not. So I'm not sure I can answer that 100% for you.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Okay. Seeing none, I would like to welcome Brian Hatfield. And yes, please begin.
Okay, good morning. Thank you, Chair Dingra and committee members. Brian Hatfield, Legislative Director with the Office of Secretary of State, Steve Hobbs. We are signed in as other in order to bring to your attention the cost and timeline for implementation of this new filing type. From IT design, development, and testing, in order to set up this new service, we would not be able to meet the July 2022 effective date. Development and deployment for new service lines or significant system enhancements like this one take on average 6 to 9 months for deployment to the public. We would like to suggest a more obtainable effective date of July 2023 and a date specific that does not fall on the first of the month as it interferes with automated processes for annual report notification and filing deadlines. A fiscal note of approximately $455,000 has been completed with a detail of the costs and timelines involved. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Next will be Raylene Wilson.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Raylene Wilson, and I'm the Legislative and Records Manager for our Washington State Auditor, Pat McCarthy. We've signed in as other on 577-779 today. While we see the value of the bill, we have some concerns with Section 4. The state auditor does not have the authority to audit charitable organizations, except in circumstances where there's reasonable cause to believe that a misuse of state monies has occurred. We'd also like to make the committee aware that the reference in Section 4 to audit standards is not correct. As it is written now, we feel this body of work would be out of our statutory authority and more appropriate for a private CPA firm. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that. Next up is going to be Tim Parrish.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I guess, let's do this. Let's do the start the video feature. There we are. How are you, Madam Chair? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you and see you. Please begin.
Good afternoon, ma'am. I am Tim Parrish from the Project 21, which is a program of the National Center for Public Policy Research here in Washington, D.C. Thank you for allowing me to join Vice Chair Trudeau, Ranking Member Patton. I am signing on in support of Senate Bill 5779. As violent crime and general crime rates across the country have increased exponentially, the conversation about bail reform and public safety dominates legislative chambers across the country, as it is here in Washington State. As we have these conversations about bail reform and public safety, we are asking just a few simple questions of legislators. One, is the priority always being kept on justice for victims and their families first? The evaluation of community impact and public safety and the effectiveness of these types of bills that are being put forward, do they increase public safety and decrease recidivism? Communities of color are particularly interested in this conversation. As a former law enforcement officer myself, I worked in communities of color and come from communities of color as well. Full stop, criminals that have committed crimes and are violent offenders and nonviolent offenders who are prone to repeat these crimes should remain in custody. However, the merits of Senate Bill 5779 is welcome legislation that affords communities transparency and inspires accountability. If a person or organization donates to a bail fund, they should absolutely know what they're donating to and that what should be case specific. This is simply an informed investment that happens all around the country all the time. What this bill does is increases transparency and inspires accountability among members of the community and donors who are donating and participating in these types of bail funds. That's all this bill accomplishes, and we look forward to your consideration in that in advancing Senate Bill 5779. Happy to take any questions if you have any, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up is going to be Preston McCollum.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for the time. Thank you as well to Senators Patton and Honeyford for the opportunity to speak at the moment. My name is Preston McCollum. I'm a deputy prosecuting attorney with Spokane County, Washington. I am assigned to our major crimes unit and focus on primarily violent victim offenses as well as gang-related offenses. I've been working within this unit for nearly 4 years. I've been a deputy prosecutor for my entire career as an attorney. And I'm very familiar with the concept of bond, the arguments that go in to bond considerations, and very familiar with what a court and a prosecutor and defense counsel are looking at when making the arguments, you know, for bond or no bond. So I'm joining today in support of this particular bill due to the transparency that it provides to the public. As a prosecuting attorney and having engaged in discussions regarding bond, I've had many defense counsel come to me and make arguments that, you know, the bail projects or bail funds would be able to provide certain funding amounts. At the time, I didn't have any idea that these entities didn't have the transparency and oversight like a bonding agency or even a private individual would have when they're posting bond. In reading the bill, it does seem appropriate given the subject matter. The subject matter here, as some of the other commentators have indicated, is providing monies or bond amounts for individuals who have been accused of crimes. As a prosecuting attorney, I've had the occasion to be arguing for a bond or agreeing to a certain amount of bond. I've also had the unfortunate discussions that come with that when I sit down with the crime victim and explain to them why a bond is set at the way that it is, or how somebody was able to bond out with apparently no, you know, funds personally to do so. In reading the bill, it doesn't seem overly expansive. It provides transparency, which is a hallmark of, you know, Washington state law, is to provide transparency to the public, transparency to donors. I think the point was well taken, at least for me, from Mr. Parrish a moment ago, is individuals who are contributing to these types of funds are absolutely entitled to know what exactly they're giving to. And so I do believe that this bill allows the public to see exactly, you know, what is being provided. In preparing for this discussion, I did look over the purpose and intent of a number of the statutes referenced in the bill, and specifically 1909, Charitable Solutions. The purpose and intent of that title is to provide citizens of Washington with information relating to any entity that solicits funds from the public for public charitable purpose. And so here, the stated purpose of these entities is indeed to, you know, provide specific monies to these individuals. And so I do think that the bill is appropriate. And this time, more so than, you know, other moments in history, especially with, you know, we're doing this via Zoom, with, you know, less in-court or in-person opportunities to actually see and have a discourse, now is the time for more transparency, not less. And so for these reasons, I do believe that the bill is appropriate and would be helpful moving forward.
Thank you so much. Next up is Lucas Garrett.
Good morning, Senators. I'm here to speak in opposition to the proposed bill. My name is Luke Garrett. I'm a shareholder at the law firm of Schrader, Goldmark, and Bender. And before that, I spent 5 years as a public defender in Seattle. I'm here speaking in my personal capacity to oppose this legislation. Pretrial detention, that is detention in jail of individuals who have yet to be convicted of the crime on which they're held, is an immense burden and causes great suffering. It affects not just the persons detained, but also their friends, their families, coworkers, and others. It costs people their jobs, housing, childcare, coerces innocent people to accept guilty pleas. And the people hurt the most are those of lesser means. Grassroots mutual aid groups have been pooling money together for bail ever since bail was invented. The proposed legislation imposes new requirements on charitable bail funds that are not applicable to for-profit bail services, which frankly also pose the same purported public safety issues that Senator Patton spoke about. There's no reason that donors can't inquire about what the funds would be used for and decline to give if that info isn't provided to their satisfaction. It's been pointed out that there's already oversight of charitable organizations. And I haven't heard anyone say that they've identified someone who's given to a bail fund and feels like they've been misled by it. Listening here today, I get the sense that this legislation is not supported by the individuals actually giving, but rather the folks who'd like to see these operations not be operating. And so in that regard, this bill appears to be a solution in search of a problem. By singling out charitable bail funds, the legislation appears to be motivated by a concern that too many of the wrong people, that is, persons of lesser means, may be posting bail. And by imposing additional burdens on charitable bail funds, and these are burdens, it will have the effect of making it harder for persons of lesser means to post bail. That's an ugly purpose and an ugly result. I'm acquainted with Senator Dingra and Senator Solomon, and I know that's not what they want, and I'd like to believe that's the sentiment of the rest of the committee. I urge you to vote no on this proposed legislation. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much. Next up will be Nolan Hibbert-Pelly. Nolan? I think it appears we don't have Nolan with us. Do any of the members have any questions for any of the panelists? Senator Cooter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Lucas Garrett. Lucas, could you turn on your video maybe so I can, there you go.
Okay. Sorry, I'm trying to participate in multiple meetings.
That's all right. I just didn't want to ask a question to if you weren't there. So my question has to do with the current bail system and mm-hmm. if you see any need to improve that, and if so, how. And I understand what you're saying about targeting the nonprofit, I guess, the bail system there. It sounds like it's a bit of a turf war, and this is kind of cuts into it cuts into available options for people in that situation. And so I'd like to know what you think of the bail system as it currently is and what we could do to improve that. Thank you.
I'll say that I think that there are problems with the current bail system. I hadn't prepared to discuss that in the aggregate. I'll say that I think that the problems with this legislation are clear in what I articulated. I think that the bail system as a whole is a much larger conversation, probably longer than the 49 minutes we've got left. But I mean, I practiced in Seattle Municipal Court, King County Superior Court, King County District Court. I made appearances in drug court and mental health court and veterans treatment court and all those things. I mean, I'm not going to tell you these are tough issues. There are some public safety concerns, but there's also just tremendous numbers of individuals who are held for extended periods of time because they can't come up with $500 to post bail. You're homeless, you get picked up on some warrant you didn't know you had because you didn't, you don't have a mailing address for your, misdemeanor trespass case 2 years ago. I mean, those people literally lose all of their possessions when they're picked up. It rains in the park and all their paperwork is destroyed. I mean, it is a huge issue. It imposes immense costs on individuals. I mean, homeless people, but anyone who's working. I mean, yes, I think there needs to be reform.
I'll make sure I'll get your contact information to Senator Cooter, and you guys can continue this.
No, I would love to talk more, but I mean, this is part of it. I came to speak just on this specific legislation, and I think I've communicated pretty clearly. Senator Dingra, I think, can probably put you in touch with me. I'd be happy to talk further, but I mean, as a public defender, I've had people who, there are people who definitely forego their trial rights who should not forego their trial rights, speaking carefully not to violate privilege, because they need to get out. They'll lose their home. They'll lose their job. And so, yes, the bail system has all sorts of problems, and there are many needed changes. Not totally prepared to talk about that today.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, folks.
Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 5779, and we are going to go to Senate Bill 5839. Thank you, Joe. And if we can start with the briefing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Joe McKittrick, staff counsel to this committee. Senate Bill 5839 concerns creating the crime of interfering with a firefighter or emergency medical service provider. Currently, Washington has a number of laws aimed at providing a safe working environment for law enforcement and other first responders, including the crimes of disorderly conduct, when a person intentionally obstructs vehicular or pedestrian traffic, which is a misdemeanor. Failure to obey, when a person willfully fails to stop when requested or signaled to do so by law enforcement, also a misdemeanor. Obstructing a law enforcement officer, which is a gross misdemeanor. And the felony crimes of malicious mischief in the second degree, when a person creates a substantial risk of interruption or impairment of services rendered to the public by physically tampering with an emergency vehicle or property of the state, and malicious mischief in the first degree, when a person causes an interruption or impairment to services or physical damage by tampering with an emergency vehicle. If enacted, Senate Bill 5839 would create the crime of interfering with a firefighter or emergency medical service provider, which would be a gross misdemeanor punishable by up to 365 days in jail, a $5,000 fine, or both. An individual commits the crime if the individual, with knowledge that another person is a firefighter or emergency medical service provider, intentionally prevents or attempts to prevent that firefighter or emergency medical service provider from performing that person's official duties. A fiscal note has been requested for this bill, but it is not yet available. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much for that, Joe. Do any of the members have any questions for staff? Okay, seeing none, Senator Patton, would you like to speak about your bill?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you to Joe for that report. I frankly was surprised that this type of law was not on the books already. I mean, our firefighters, emergency medical technicians, and others are out there saving lives and preventing property damage. And to think that somebody, say, for example, would step on a fire hose and prevent the water going in to fight the fire when some of our firefighters might even be inside a building is reprehensible. So you'll hear some testimony on this. I think this is supported by the fire chiefs throughout the state and makes some common sense and is another public safety piece of legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Patton. Do any of the members have any questions for Senator Patton? Okay, seeing none, I would like to call Brian Collins to please begin this testimony. Okay, while we wait for Brian to come up, John, would you like to start, please? Oh, there we go. Actually, Brian Collins, you're here. Please begin.
Good morning. Thank you, committee members, for allowing me to take just a minute to offer my support for Senate Bill 5839. My name is Brian Collins. I'm a 38-year veteran of the fire service, and I serve as a fire chief of the Spokane Valley Fire Department. I'd like to thank the committee members for taking this up. First and foremost, in order for firefighters and EMS workers to fulfill their mission, they must first gain access to an emergency. Far too often across our state, our personnel are obstructed and at times assaulted while attempting to render care or mitigate fires and other emergencies. Examples include fire setters who attempt to obstruct and slow down our personnel in hopes that a fire will grow, to medical emergencies where illegal activities may have taken place or people are inebriated or large crowds have gathered and they do not want to see us treat the patient. It also occurs with illegal burning responses when firefighters met with sometimes hostile or aggressive behavior during our efforts to extinguish those dangerous fires. This bill provides our law enforcement partners the ability to cite individuals when situations like this occur and jeopardize emergency responders' ability to render care or mitigate emergencies. This type of legislation has been enacted in numerous states across our country. And I, along with many Washington fire chiefs, firefighters, and EMS chiefs, would appreciate the committee's support on this bill.
Thank you. John Sison, and apologize if I mispronounced your last name.
Hi, good morning. My name is John Sison. I live in Gig Harbor, Washington, but I was a firefighter in Seattle for about 21 years. And when this bill is brought to me actually by the House, the first thing I thought of was not actually like emergency scenes that we go on. It's the gray area stuff we go on. You know, when we go on calls with the police department, a lot of the there's cut and dry ordinances and laws that we follow. Well, there's gray area stuff when we go to enforce like parks department ordinances, you know, like on Alki Beach when it, you know, they have burn pits that people could use for fires on the beach and times that they need to clear because there's residents that live on the beach in condos. And especially these last two summers when people were out of control, we would go down there to put out a beach fire that was either not in a pit or it was stacks of pallets that they're burning on the beach. And it was just a hostile environment, and it was too hostile for the fire department to go in there. And this isn't like a hazard to life or property or anything like that. It was just a nuisance to the tax-paying citizens. And when they call 911, they want us to take care of it. But if it's too dangerous for firefighters to go into, something like this would give the cops or the police department a tool in the box to utilize to help us manage something as simple as putting out a beach fire that's a nuisance fire. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Do any of the members have any questions for our testifiers? Okay. Seeing none, that concludes the public hearing on Senate Bill 5839. And we are going to move into public hearing on Senate Bill 5877. And I'd like to invite staff to please begin with the.
Good morning, Chair Dingra and members of the committee. My name is Tim Ford, staff with the committee. And Senate Bill 5877 relates to anti-discrimination policies in institutions of higher ed. By way of background, the state need grant was modified in 2019 and renamed the Washington College Grant, which is the state's largest financial aid program, provides awards to low-income students to pursue their post-secondary education. It's an entitlement program with guaranteed awards for those students who qualify. And the amount varies based upon the institution that the student attends and the student's family income. For students attending state's public institutions, the maximum award is tuition and services and activity fees for 15 quarter credit hours or the equivalent. For students attending private four-year not-for-profit higher education institutions, the maximum award last from 2019 to 2020 was $9,739. And also, the Washington law against discrimination provides or prohibits discriminatory practices in employment, and that includes places of public resort, accommodation or amusement, real estate transactions, and credit and insurance. That law protects people from discrimination based on their race, creed, color, national origin, families with children, sex, marital status, sexual orientation, age, honorably discharged veterans, or military status. It also protects people from discrimination based upon disabilities and prohibits retaliation against persons who oppose discriminatory practices. So what this bill does is it imports certain definitions from the Washington law against discrimination, and it includes them in the higher education law for student financial aid programs. And so some of those definitions include the definition of a disability, dog guide, employer, marital status, national origin, person, race, service animal, sex, and sexual orientation. The maximum Washington College grant is changed for students attending private four-year not-for-profit institutions of higher education in Washington. The act increases the award to be the equivalent of the maximum award at the public higher ed institutions. Every 4 years, institutions of higher ed participating in the college grant program must either sign an affidavit that the institution's policies and practices are in compliance with anti-discrimination provisions or it must affirmatively opt out of anti-discrimination requirements. And so these anti-discrimination provisions in the bill prohibit discrimination on the same basis as is prohibited under the Washington law against discrimination. And for institutions that opt out, students are entitled to only 85% of the Washington College Grant Award. If an institution has signed an affidavit, but then engages in discriminatory practices, it is deemed an unfair practice, and the Attorney General shall investigate complaints and enforce the bill to restrain the prohibited practices. Institutions that have signed the affidavit but are deemed to engage in an unfair practice are limited to 85% of the grant program. And finally, in addition to the authority of the Attorney General, any person who has been injured by a violation has a cause of action, a civil cause of action in court to enjoin those violations or to recover actual damages together with a cost of reasonable attorney fees and court costs. Any other questions?
Thank you so much for that. Do any of the members have any questions for staff? Okay, seeing no hands raised, I'm going to welcome Senator Wynn to the Law and Justice Committee. He is going to speak about the bill instead of the prime sponsor, Senator Conway. So with that, Senator Wynn, welcome.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Wynn, State Senator from the 34th Legislative District. And this is a bill that actually came to me by some of the members within the independent colleges and the need to have more parity in terms of funding for our college students to be able to access education that is commensurate with their needs as well. And candidly, as a person who went to a private institution, I know that this would have benefited myself and other folks like me being able to kind of get access to at the very least the education that I have. We do know that we need to have more funding for higher education in general. And I think one of the ways for us to do this is be able to give access to the state need grant. And in this bill, kind of what Tim had done a great job describing is being able to kind of open that up to folks who would be able to live up to these values as well in Washington State. So I was just pinch hitting real quick for Senator Conway, but did want to show my support for this piece of policy. We have been working with stakeholders over the interim to figure out a path that would work for as many people as possible. And I commend this to the body for their support.
Thank you so much for that. And I see Senator Wagner has his hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, Senator Conway isn't here because the question probably more properly applies to him. I'm wondering if there is a particular problem that we're seeing that motivated him to bring this bill to us, because it seems to me the Attorney General would already be empowered to investigate cases of discrimination under the higher law that was referred to. So I'm a little curious if there was something that motivated him to focus on this area of discrimination. It seems redundant to me.
Senator Wynn, do you want to take a stab at that, or should we table that?
Yeah.
And find Senator Conway?
I don't want to speak on behalf of Senator Conway. I know that this is something he's been working on for the past couple of years. So I know that there are institutions in the Pierce County area that has been wanting to have some of these changes, and same thing with other jurisdictions. So I'll defer to him, but I know that this has been an issue he's been working on for the past couple of years that I think he's going to speak upon better.
Thank you. Fair enough.
Thank you. Any other questions for either staff or the prime sponsor? Okay. Seeing none, with that, I am going to call up the only person who signed in to testify. A lot of individuals who signed in not testifying. Gregory Baylor, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Baylor. I serve as senior counsel for government affairs and director of the Center for Law, Center for Religious Schools at Alliance Defending Freedom, which is an organization that's dedicated to protecting religious liberty for people of all faiths and none. I'm here today to testify against SB 5877, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to share many of the concerns that we have with this piece of legislation. When you get right down to it, you know, the essence of this bill is the infliction of a penalty of a $1,500 penalty on students, economically disadvantaged students by definition, because they're participating in this program. They will suffer this penalty if they choose a school, often for their own religious reasons, that engages in certain common practices. I thought it would be worthwhile to list some of the current common practices that would be jeopardized under this statute, and students would suffer if schools continue to engage in them. The first one has to do with sports. The statute contains a ban on gender identity discrimination, and in many jurisdictions that has been interpreted to require educational institutions to allow males, biological males who identify as female, to participate in women's sports. This is terribly unfair to women, and it undermines the purpose of Title IX. Second, single-sex dormitories. Many institutions, including in the state of Washington, have dorms that are set aside for men or for women. Obviously, there's co-ed dorms as well. This statute would put pressure on institutions to eliminate single-sex dormitories and thereby eliminate a choice that many students, particularly women, want. Also, it would jeopardize single-sex private facilities like locker rooms. Now, those sorts of problems, I think, are real for all institutions in the state, but it bears noting that there are some additional problems that are essentially uniquely borne by the faith-based institutions in the state. First, as to students, many religious institutions have policies and practices regarding admission, regarding student conduct, and the like that reflect their beliefs, their sincerely held religious beliefs about admittedly controversial issues like the definition of marriage, sexual morality, and the distinction between the sexes. And in every state and at the federal level, there's been a large measure of respect for the freedom of religious institutions to sort of maintain their character exemptions from certain non-discrimination laws. Employers, religious employers have always had and should have and are constitutionally required to have the ability to draw their workforce from among those who share their religious convictions, both doctrinal and behavioral. And this bill, if it went through, would really undermine the ability of institutions to maintain those policies. The other bad option, if they do maintain those policies, is for, the students to suffer a $1,500 tax, as it were, to attend the school of their choice to exercise their own religion. So in conclusion, I would like to urge the committee to vote against SB 5877, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Do any of the members have any questions? Senator Patton.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Baylor. Thank you for appearing before us and giving your viewpoints. Is there any constitutional problems with this legislation? That's question number one. Question number two, are there any cases working their way through the federal courts that would apply to this type of policy?
In answer to your first question, and thank you for it, Senator Patton, Madam Chair, may I answer the question? Thank you.
Yes,
yeah, there are a number of significant constitutional problems with this. Essentially, the state would be saying, we're going to diminish the amount of money that you receive if you give up constitutionally protected behavior. The hiring practices, the admissions practices, and the student conduct codes that institutions have are all exercises of their religion in the kind of circumstances that we're talking about. And the government is not permitted to say, look, if you want this benefit, you have to give up those practices. Also, there's a constitutional rights of students are impacted as well. They have a choice. They have the freedom to choose based on their religion, an institution that shares their religious convictions. And this places a burden on that as well. In the employment setting, there is an extraordinarily narrow exception from the ban on creed discrimination, which is new to this statute. It's only for those who work in the theology department. That is much narrower than the Constitution requires. The Constitution requires, at the very least, the so-called ministerial exception. And the definition of minister is a lot broader than folks who just work in the theology department. Now, your other question was about, are there other cases kind of in are there cases rather in the federal system that are working their way up that might be germane to this circumstance? There's one off the top of my head I can think of is pretty much right on point. The state of Maryland has a K-12 school choice program. I know it's K-12, but the principles are the same. And they attached certain non-discrimination strings, even on religious schools, undermining their ability to live out their faith. And those strings were challenged. And the district court in Maryland recently held that it was unconstitutional for the state to do what it had done. Hope that's helpful, Senator Patton.
Thank you. Okay. Seeing no more hands raised, we are going to conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 5877. And we're going into public hearing on Senate Bill 5927.
Thank you again, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Joe McKittrick, staff counsel to this committee. Senate Bill 5927 concerns the safety and security of retail cannabis outlets. By way of background, Washington legalized recreational use of cannabis in 2012. And since legalization, cannabis outlets have been frequent targets of robberies. Since November 2021, in Washington, there have been more than 30 crimes committed against cannabis retailers. And often these crimes take the form of coordinated robberies involving multiple armed individuals. A person commits the crime of robbery if the person takes personal property from the person of another or in that person's presence against that person's will by the use or threatened use of immediate force, violence, or fear of injury to that person, the person's property, or the person or property of another. A person who commits a robbery is guilty of the crime of robbery in the second degree, a Class B felony. If the person commits a robbery and in the commission of the robbery or in the immediate flight therefrom is armed with a deadly weapon, inflicts bodily injury, or commits the robbery against a financial institution, the crime is elevated to robbery in the first degree, a Class A felony. If enacted, Senate Bill 5927 would add a special allegation and sentencing enhancement applicable to the crime of robbery in the first or second degree. If it is pled and proven beyond a reasonable doubt that a person has committed a robbery of a cannabis retail outlet, where the person committed the robbery as a premeditated act in concert with others, the person convicted would face a sentencing enhancement of 12 months in prison, in addition to the individual's underlying standard sentence. This bill would also require retail cannabis outlets to report any attempt or incident of first or second degree robbery to the Liquor and Cannabis Control Board within 10 days of the incident. The chief enforcement officer of the Liquor and Cannabis Control Board must regularly consult with the Washington State Patrol to provide details of incidents of robbery and to discuss any evidence that indicates a pattern of or coordinated effort by a criminal enterprise. A fiscal note has been requested for this bill, but it is not yet available. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much for that briefing, Joe. Do any members of the committee have questions for staff? Okay, seeing none, Senator Honeyford, would you like to speak to your bill? Senator Honeyford, you're on mute. There we go.
Sometimes when I hit that button, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill violates one of my positions that I don't vote for any marijuana bills, but this one is a little different. I believe it's extremely important. I remind you of Willie Sutton. Someone asked him, and he denies the answer, but they ask him why he robbed banks, and he said that's where the money is. Well, people are robbing the cannabis stores because they have to deal in cash due to federal banking rules, and so that's where the money is, and that's where they're going, and I anticipate that this will continue unless we take action, and sometime there will be some fatal results. I'm concerned that that will happen. So I appreciate the hearing on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for bringing this bill forward, Senator Honeyford. Any questions from any of our members? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to now invite Chris Thompson to please come on camera, introduce yourself, and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Thompson here representing the Liquor and Cannabis Board. We're in support of Senate Bill 5927. While we don't have super good data on the incidences at the heart of the concern around this bill, it does appear like this problematic activity is on the rise. And we believe this bill would make some improvements in terms of both public safety and officer safety. So we commend it to you. And that's what I wanted to say, Madam Chair. I'll try to answer any questions that the committee has.
Thank you. Next up will be Mark Johnson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mark Johnson, Senior Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs for the Washington Retail Association, here today representing 4,500 storefronts throughout the state. We have members ranging in size from the world's largest to the sole proprietor, with over 90% of our membership having 50 or fewer employees. We are here today to offer our support for Senate Bill 5927, the Cannabis Retail Crime Act. We appreciate the prime sponsor, Senator Honeyford, for championing this very important issue. WR has a number of cannabis retailers in our membership. These retailers have been suffering from increasingly frequent and violent and costly thefts, often committed by retail theft crime rings. The safety of our employees and customers is of the utmost importance. Washington State ranks second in the nation in theft per capita, with over $2.7 billion in goods stolen from retailers every year. This leads to increased costs to consumers and millions in lost tax revenues for state and local governments. Many retail thefts are committed by teams of criminals, usually having a lookout or multiple lookouts or multiple accomplices, sometimes overwhelming store clerks. These are sophisticated operations, often with ties to human trafficking, drug smuggling, terrorism, pornography, and a myriad of other crimes. SB 5927 is one prong in a multi-pronged approach needed to combat retail theft and protect public safety. This legislation will both serve as a deterrent to would-be criminals and as a tool for law enforcement and prosecutors in arresting and convicting retail cannabis thieves. I commend the bill to you and ask for your favorable action. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next up will be James Adams.
Hi, my name is James Adams. I work at Mr. Green's. I've been a bartender there for 3 years, as well as have a heart. And a lot of these crimes I've noticed don't really get reported to the media. When I was working a couple of times, there's been local places a couple miles away that have gotten hit, and the local police have come and informed me, as well as a lot of my close friends within the last month or so have also had similar experiences with people coming in. So I do see this as a big problem, and everybody in the industry that works in retail is worried about this and worried about getting robbed. So I'm very happy that you guys are giving time to help us out here. I greatly appreciate it. And I also represent UFCW, the union that represents retail cannabis workers.
Thank you so much for that. Next up is going to be John Worthington.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. This is evidence of the huge regulatory problem we have at the Liquor Board. They meet off the side with WAPA and WASPIS and this whole cast of characters who get federal funding, and they do the rulemaking and all the policy making off on the side. So what you have is this over-regulation for the purpose of keeping the old players in the game. And this is a regulatory problem. I urge you to vote against the bill, because if you want to take marijuana out of commodity status so people aren't robbing, you have to have a proper regulatory board. You can't have the wolves building the hen house. And that's what you got right now with all these organizations on the side working with the governor's buddies, and you get horrible regulatory process. And this is just evidence that you're not treating it like a non-commodity, and you're acknowledging that it is a commodity. And then some of these guys are just running on a hamster wheel. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of, you got too much market glut, and a lot of these robberies, like in the medical marijuana industry, end up kind of being inside jobs because you can't really make it. So you got to go back to the regulatory end of this thing. You got to kick the foxes out of the picture and have experts help you build a proper regulatory model. Senator Huntington, he admits he doesn't really want it. And there's a lot of other people who don't really want it. But we need good regulation, sound regulation. If you don't find yourself passing a law like this to deal with broccoli or an onion or something on the shelf, you're admitting, it's tantamount to admitting that you have poor regulatory process and you haven't eliminated marijuana from being a commodity for the benefit of these people who have been feeding off marijuana, the commodity, for years. And they get into the back room and take our policy making off into the back room, where now the equity gang joins them. So I'm not really happy with our regulatory process, as you can see, and I would like to see you deal with that before you pile on more criminal expense that the public kind of voted we weren't going to do because we were tired of doing that. So appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for testifying. Next up is going to be Caitlin Ryan.
I apologize. We had a celebration with the LGBTQ community this weekend, and I have not changed my background, but we'll let it be sparkly. My name is Caitlin Ryan, and I'm the interim executive director for the Cannabis Alliance. We're the largest member-driven industry organization in Washington State, and we are dedicated to the advancement of a vital, ethical, and sustainable cannabis industry. We are signing an other on this bill after a great deal of soul-searching and conversation. This legislation has sparked meaningful and thoughtful debate in our leadership, our committees, and more broadly across our organization. This is not an abstract discussion, but it is material and painful and immediate. And this bill seeks to provide some protection. This bill offers solace that someone is actually doing something about the crisis our retail stores are facing as armed robberies continue to escalate. We are intimately connected to this issue. One of our most respected community stores with representation in the Cannabis Alliance as a long-term founding board member is currently coping with the aftermath of a tragic and brutal attack at one of their stores a few weeks ago, an attack that has left a young person just 22 years old fighting for their life. We understand the desire behind this legislation is to do something, anything, to give us a feeling of control over a terrifying situation, one that is not getting any better. However, while this legislation might make us feel like we have agency in this terrifying and heartbreaking situation, we are deeply concerned that in the end, we will not see an impactful change other than possibly putting more people in jail with slightly longer sentences. A person who is desperate enough to rob a store at gunpoint is likely to not consider or even be aware of the nuances of sentencing law. Additionally, given the disproportionate application of sentencing enhancements given to Black and Brown people, we fear this may only serve as another tool for furthering an already inequitable and catastrophic incarceration endemic in America. Perpetrators are not thinking about consequences beyond getting what they seek, and what they seek in our stores is cash. We are not in opposition of this bill. We would simply like to offer a moment of pause to search our hearts regarding practical approaches to the root problem before contributing to the overwhelmingly high percentage of Americans in prison. We would ask that our state, our legislators, lead a coordinated effort to push on the federal government to once and for all give our businesses access to credit card processing. We believe reducing the advertised cash on hand would be a true practical solution that would reduce the incentive for this type of violence. The proposed state bank may also provide solutions. With the majority of the country having some form of cannabis legalization, it simply makes no sense for us to be forced into an all-cash business. We implore you to take action that will truly help our industry reduce the terrible violence we are facing. Thank you for your time today and your patience with my background.
Thank you. I think your background definitely was a great addition to the testimony we heard today. Next up is going to be Vicki Christopherson.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Vicki Christofferson. I represent the Washington Cannabis Business Association. We represent cannabis businesses across the spectrum from retailers, transporters, and producer processors. And here today in support of this bill is one piece of a robust strategy we believe that the state should employ to deal with this issue. I just want to mention that the problem that we're seeing is definitely predominantly at retail stores, but we also have had some of our transporters targeted as they're moving product and cash, frankly, and also producer processors. So the industry is definitely a target. It's definitely an attractive target because, as you've heard, there is a lot of cash. Unfortunately, Senator Honeyford, this has resulted in a death. In fact, several years ago, there was a retail clerk who was kidnapped as part of a robbery and ultimately lost his life. So we applaud the legislature for trying to look at this issue. It's very important. It's critically important that there is an approach to it. We support this bill as one piece of a total strategy that could work to thwart these thieves as they target our businesses. And thank you for taking the time to hear it.
Thank you. Next up is going to be Aidan Espino, Jr.
Thank you. Hello, Chair Dingra, Ranking Member Patton, and members of the committee. I am Aidan Espino, and I'm the Executive Director of the Craft Cannabis Coalition, an association of over 40 retail cannabis stores, and we are strongly in support of SB 5927. You have heard from our other friends in the testimony room here that there's been a dramatic rise to robberies. I had sent information to committee members to help provide some data and for illustrate this that our members have been record keeping for ourselves. But just to provide some high level information, there have been over 35 robberies at cannabis retail stores since January 1st. You know, that's more than one a night. And cannabis retail stores, as you know, have to deal with cash, but we also have more cash just in general to put it in perspective than banks do. So we are particularly vulnerable because of this cash-based only system and that many of our, we are also unarmed at these locations. There's a retail store owner here to present the realities that they're facing. So I'll leave my testimony there, but I do want to note that many of our members wanted to share their stories, but given the situation, we're fearful of identifying themselves. I greatly appreciate the Craft Cannabis Coalition, greatly appreciates the attention to this issue that the committee has given. And we greatly thank Senator Honeyford and Senator Saldana for their sponsorship. And we ask you to pass SB 5927 out of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up is Shay Haynes.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for being here today. My name is Shay Hines. I'm a co-founder of retail cannabis stores in Seattle. We're a family-owned and operating business. I've been involved personally in cannabis retail sales since the medical days in 2001. I'm here today to testify in strong support of SB 5927. During my over a decade of selling cannabis out of storefronts, my staff and businesses have never been the victim of a robbery. Until recently, we've had three armed robberies over the course of the last 3 weeks. Robbers with guns entering our stores, sticking up our staff, and violating our well-being. Aidan mentioned that there's a Google Sheet, a 502 robbery tracker that's been put together by various industry members and advocates to try to quantify this issue. Armed robberies in cannabis stores are skyrocketing at alarming rates over the last 6 months. Masking in the pandemic has only made it worse. My count also shows 35 robberies in the last month alone, again, over one a day. I understand this is a very sensitive subject and asking for increased penalties for crimes, but I'm here today to ask for relief. This is not just a policing issue. This is not just an epidemic of crime and violence that we've seen in our neighborhoods. This is a people problem. My staff are scared. I have staff members who have had guns pointed in their face twice in the last 3 weeks. SB 5927 would bring parity to the cannabis retail robberies and pharmacy robberies. There was a similar bill to address a spike in pharmacy robberies years back, and it helped provide quite a lot of relief to that industry. I want to note that both pharmacies and cannabis retail stores traffic in a controlled substance with really high residual street value. cannabis is a federally illegal, it's a Schedule I narcotic, and due to this, our businesses are forced to operate in cash only due to lack of federal banking support. As a large revenue generator for the state, I believe over $500 million last year in excise tax alone, we're looking to the state to provide some help to this important issue that's affecting our staff and our well-being. Thank you for your time and your thoughtful consideration on this important issue.
Thank you. Do any of the members of the committee have any questions for any of our panelists? Senator Wagner.
Actually, my question is for the bill sponsor, Madam Chair.
Go for it. We have time.
Okay, thank you. Senator Honeyford, I'm wondering if you feel that the enhancement for the use of a deadly weapon, specifically firearms, is covered by existing law, or if there's room in your bill to stiffen things if you use a firearm, which would be my instinct.
I believe there's room to stiffen it, yes.
Okay, Senator Patton.
Yeah, I have a question maybe for Ms. Christofferson. Can you update us on any effort on the federal level to change your industry from cash only to some combination of credit card and cash?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Patton. That's a great question. There is a piece of legislation that has now passed the Congress, U.S. House of Representatives, three times. At least twice. It's called the Safe Banking Act. What the law would do is provide banks the comfort that they could bank with the industry by allowing them to do so. Right now, the banks are many banks are concerned because of the status of cannabis legally. And that in particular, as others have noticed, affects our ability to use credit card processing because the credit card processing companies will not bank with that, will not allow that. Safe banking is, I think, currently sitting in the U.S. Senate. It has had a hearing. We believe we've counted the votes. We have the votes. We just sure would like the leadership to bring it up for a vote. So to the extent that this committee and the legislature could help put the pressure on the feds, that bill would have a dramatic impact on the public safety in this state. Thanks.
One follow-up, if I might, Chair Dingra. What about, I've heard that some credit unions do provide some financial services. Is that correct?
That's correct. We do. We are very lucky, particularly in Washington and in Colorado, that several of our credit unions have chosen to bank with the industry. That solves the problem for us in terms of the ability of the company to work with a bank. But you still have to collect that cash at the retail store. So the customer can only pay in cash. And so what the stores are having to do is have armored cars come to pick it up. There is a lot of cash. And we're talking, I don't want to advertise, we're talking a lot of cash that are in these businesses. And so that is the piece that causes that public safety issue. We could not be happier that our credit unions have stepped up and taken that on to bank with the industry. It's provided us with a lot of relief, but it doesn't solve the entire problem, including others that our employees face and others as a result of not having the Safe Banking Act acted on.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, we are now going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 5927. And with that, we are done with the Senate Law and Justice Committee for today. Thank you all, and we will see you tomorrow.